second case for oral argument this morning is Bonham County Commission versus AFSCME and Kingsbury County Commission versus AFSCME. For the appellant counties are is Mr. Mark Fallison, is that correct?
Fallison, sir.
Fallison, all right, attorney from Lincoln, Nebraska. And then Ms. Viken, you represent AFSCME, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. All right, you have 20 minutes, counsel.
Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Mark Fallison. I'm the attorney for appellants Kingsbury County Commission and Bonham County Commission in these two cases that have been consolidated for purposes of oral argument this morning. Also with me this morning is Lisa Rothschadel, who is the Bonham County State's Attorney. Unable to attend was Gary Schumacher, the Kingsbury County State's Attorney, who has been deployed to Iraq. For purposes of simplicity today, I would ask to be able to refer to the appellee as Union, although there are some disparity between whether they're different locals or not, so simply refer to the Union as the Union and the counties as the county, unless there's a distinction between Bonham or Kingsbury that is relevant to these decisions. Today, I would like to initially provide an overview of the history of public sector collective bargaining here in the state of South Dakota. It's important to build upon that history to understand where we're at with respect to the issues involved in these two cases. I will give a brief summary factual background of the two cases, highlighting some of the distinctions between the two. And there are countless issues raised in the various briefs. In my brief time this morning, I wish to focus on four. First, why the union's unfair labor practice charge in the Bonham County case is time barred. Two, why the Department of Labor and Management and Circuit Court erred in finding that the county's bargaining to impasse over the issue of management rights was an unfair labor practice. Three, why the Circuit Court erred in reversing the department's decision with respect to offers made in the course of mediation. And lastly, why the Circuit Court erred in reversing the Department of Labor and Management and concluding that the county was required to implement all of its last, best, and final offer upon reaching an impasse. First, the history of public sector negotiations here in the state of South Dakota. In 1935, our federal government adopted the National Labor Relations Act, which governs private sector negotiations. And nearly 30 years later, in 1962, this court in Levasseur versus Wielden held that public employees, in fact, had the right to join labor unions, but did not have the right to bargain collectively and did not have the right to strike. It wasn't until 7 years later, in 1969, that our state legislature granted public employees a very limited collective bargaining right, which was modeled entirely after the Federal National Labor Relations Act. 4 years later, in 1973, the South Dakota legislature added the obligation for both parties to negotiate in good faith and introduced the concept of an unfair labor practice charge. Again, this legislation was modeled after the Federal National Labor Relations Act. It is for this reason that from the very first case decided under that act, which was the Aberdeen case, through the most recent case, which I believe was the Council on Higher Education case decided by this court, all of those cases have generally looked to precedent under the Federal National Labor Relations Act in trying to construe the provisions of our state law. The history of South Dakota public sector bargaining is detailed in a 1979 South Dakota Law Review article, which is in our materials, and that's relevant because it was written by the Secretary of Labor at the time, who was intimately involved in drafting and developing the law which we are currently forced to deal with. In that article, Secretary Finch said, "In how matters are resolved in the state of South Dakota is this: ultimately, it is the employer who must decide how the dispute will be resolved." That quote was cited by this court in South Dakota Board of Regents versus Hagee. Again, that whether that was in dicta or whether that was part of the holding can be argued, but nevertheless, it was cited as supportive of the process here in South Dakota in that particular case. Secretary Finch said that if there was to be a different resolution process in the state of South Dakota, it was the South Dakota legislature which was to adopt a different procedure, such as binding arbitration. Some states have done that. For example, the state of Minnesota has a procedure that establishes binding arbitration in resolving disputes when they reach impasse. The state of Nebraska has adopted an administrative agency in which that agency resolves those disputes. The state of South Dakota has adopted the same procedure which exists under federal law, which is upon reaching impasse, the employer has the right to implement all or portions of its last, best, and final offer. Now, that impasse is temporary. That impasse continues to exist until broken, and so the parties can come back to the bargaining table at any time to negotiate those issues.
Right, but here, if we look at the text of what you asked the union to agree to, the management prerogatives look basically to expand to such a point that there, what's left to bargain over?
Okay.
Haven't you just basically done away with the process you're talking about?
We disagree, Your Honor. A couple of points in response to that. First, it's important to note that at least in the Kingsbury County case, the record will demonstrate that this particular union had agreed to similar, if not identical, language in the past, so it was not uncommon for us to negotiate for that language. Two, with respect to that language, bear in mind that the county came to the bargaining table with that language and asked the union to make changes. I think the record, a fair reading of the record in both cases, will demonstrate that the union essentially said, we're not interested in talking about that. In one of the cases, they offered an alternative, which is essentially a one or two sentence provision, which says the union and the employer get those rights guaranteed to them by law. And so while the employer, I believe, came to the bargaining table willing to discuss those, and the record would demonstrate made some changes, the union was not willing to negotiate in good faith bargaining over what should be included in that language. Again, the decision of whether to change this procedure, we would contend, is not a decision for the South Dakota Department of Labor and Management. It is not a decision for the courts. The legislature purposely modeled our procedure after that which exists under federal law, and it is the legislature which has to change that if, in fact, change is needed. Again, what is the process as recognized by this court for how non-school district negotiations work in the state of South Dakota? Section 3-18-2 obligates the parties to negotiate in good faith, but is recognized by this court in several decisions that obligation does not compel either the union or the public employer to agree to any particular proposal or even to make concessions. All that is required is a statement of rationale for any position taken in negotiations.
Well, let's go to the rationale. That's what's concerning me. The clause that was proposed here is very long, seems like it's very broad, but when you give, when you talk about the rationale, there doesn't seem to be much specificity to it. And during the negotiations, if I understand correctly, the rationale that was given was simply that the counties needed more flexibility. Can you tell me now, what specific concerns did the county have that required this broad clause?
Sure, and to be specific, Your Honor, I'll refer to the Kingsbury County case because that's one example that comes to mind. In that particular case, the employer mentioned their desire to subcontract with the neighboring county regarding some provisions, I think sharing of roads equipment, sharing perhaps of employees. And they said that often those instances arise such that they can't call the union together, have a bargaining session over whether they can have their workers going to work for another county or whether having Kingsbury County's work being displaced by workers from another county. And this is particularly highlighted given the fact that this particular union in this case refused to negotiate over the telephone or telephone conferences, refused to negotiate via fax, the electronic transmission. And so it required face-to-face meetings to do these negotiations. That, I believe, is an example of the flexibility that was required in at least one of the cases.
And which part of, or which section then would have covered that necessity?
Your Honor, I don't have the actual management rights proposal in front of me, but certainly if I recall, there's language in there about the right to subcontract work. And again,
not specifically with another county. I mean, it wasn't
as specific as you're saying here.
That is correct. It didn't mention a specific county or just say it's counties. It could be that a negotiated agreement was with another political subdivision other than a county. It could be a nearby city. Again, flexibility was the key, and I think it's important to look at the factual setting in which this occurred. County negotiator comes to table with a proposal, and the union adopted a take-it-or-leave-it approach. They were not interested in discussing the issue of management rights.
Well, if I understand, though, the counties took the same approach, take it or leave it, too. The only changes that the counties were willing to make to this provision were changes that obviously applied only to the private sector. Otherwise, the county was not pretty particularly movable on this issue either, was it?
We would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. Again, we repeatedly asked the union for, okay, if you don't like the proposals, point to us those which you don't like. As you mentioned, they highlighted those that perhaps dealt more directly with private sector, and those were struck. We repeatedly went back to them, tell us what you don't like. And one of the particular cases, the union negotiator even cut off one of his union members from engaging in that discussion. The particular union negotiator, Mr. Allard, cut off a gentleman by the name of, I believe, Mike Nelson, who began to say, okay, here's what I have a problem with it, and Allard cut him off, said, no, we're not going to talk about it. And so again, I would just ask the court to place itself in the shoes of the county negotiator. This language had been previously agreed to. Management rights have been recognized, repeatedly negotiated for in the state of South Dakota. A 1969 legislative report, which is cited and attached as Appendix C to our reply brief, clearly mentions that, and I quote, there are several methods that have been suggested to appropriately limit the scope of collective negotiation between a public employer and its employees. One way of limiting the scope of negotiations is to negotiate a strong management rights clause. In such a clause, which is included in the contract with the employee organization agrees that management alone is responsible for making certain types of policies, including determination of the mission of the agency, staff structure, and budget.
But were those weren't the probably the provisions that the union was concerned about. Wouldn't you agree that they would be more concerned about those provisions that say that the county retains the right to establish work schedules and starting times and number of hours to be worked in a day and those kinds of provisions, which are clearly they have a right to bargain for?
In response, Your Honor, let me continue with the quote from the legislative report, which was given to our legislature prior to adopting the 73 changes. Goes on to say that many contracts also include a provision that states that the management has a sole authority to make such decisions as directing the workforce, hiring, promotion, discharge, and maintaining discipline. Again, the factual saying in this case is we weren't able to get to that point. It was the union that took the take-it-or-leave-it approach. They would not discuss in detail what their concerns were. And again, it took the county negotiator aback because this is something that had been previously agreed to in countless counties across the state.
Identical?
I believe that there's at least one instance, Your Honor, in which it was identical, and that would be in the record in the Kingsbury County case. Otherwise, there are many instances in which it's virtually identical. Continuing on with respect to the process in South Dakota in non-school district negotiations, Section 13-18-8.1 says that in the case of impasse or failure to reach an agreement, either party may request the South Dakota Department of Labor and Management to conciliate or to do fact-finding, but again, this is non-binding. Upon reaching impasse, it is the employer that is given the unilateral right to implement its last, best, and final offer or portions thereof. It has been the holding in the Council of Higher Education case. It has been the holding in the Sisseton Education Association case, in which this court said that the union does not enjoy a unilateral veto over proposals of the employer, and the public sector employer can achieve its bargaining objectives by using its economic weapon of implementing at impasse. Again,
excuse me, will you remind me now, what did they actually then implement? Did they implement this provision here, the management rights clause, when the impasse, what did the county implement that in its last best offer?
Yes, it would have been implemented.
That provision they did, but the increase in wages they did not.
There are certain provisions, correct, there were certain provisions which were implemented, and in this instance, the county reserved the right not to implement the wage increase. I believe, again, this is outside of the record, and one of the cases is eventually paid. But in any event, the employer retains that right.
I understand which ones they picked.
Correct.
To implement and which ones they did not.
But there are other provisions which are favorable to the employees, we would contend, that were also implemented.
Well, just for the clarity's sake here, the full management rights clause that the union wanted, that was fully implemented. They didn't delete any section from that.
Deleted those which they had previously agreed to.
Agreed to, obviously, correct. but the final demand of the counties on this waiver clause, this was fully implemented.
Correct. But again, there's no evidence in the record to establish that the the union or its members have been harmed in any way by the implementation of those provisions. Certainly, this has been implemented long before these cases came to trial. And again, there's no suggestion that they're in any way harmed.
But the question comes down, doesn't it, counsel, to good faith? Because here, this was an issue that was hotly contested, and yet an issue that was not particularly contested was the increase in wages, and the counties vote elect not to increase the wages. So doesn't that reflect on the good faith of the county?
We would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Again, I believe it was in the Kingsbury case, the union attempted to pick and choose which provisions that the county can implement. They said you can implement X, Y, and Z. And again, that is the employer's prerogative to decide which ones to implement. And the economic issues certainly were not that easy. I mean, you mentioned that certainly the management rights provision was hotly contested. We would suggest the record also demonstrates that the wage issue was hotly contested as well. And so, again, those economic issues, which ultimately are perhaps the most important in some of these discussions, the employer retains the right to decide whether to implement those or not.
You mentioned in your argument that they were not harmed, that the union was not harmed by the implementation of this management rights clause. Is that some criteria that you get out of a case
site
or anything?
But to the extent the union is claiming that this provision was this horrible of horribles, there is no evidence in the record to suggest that the county has used that in any way to harm the union or its members. Let me, with the few minutes I have left in my direct, let me just touch upon my four basic arguments. We believe that the Bonham County case can be quickly dismissed because it's time barred. Section 3-18-3.4 mandates that unfair labor practice charge be filed either within 60 days after the commission of the alleged ULP or within 60 days after the complainant should have known of the alleged unfair labor practice charge. In the findings of fact filed by the union, they said the union said that they filed the unfair labor practice charge on March 29th. At hearing, they changed that hearing before the circuit court, so it was actually March 25th. Assuming that is correct, which we assume only for sake of argument, then the 60-day window was from March 25, 1999, back to January 25, 1999, and there's not a single operative act which occurred in that 60-day window which would have given rise to the action which is currently before this court. What would have given rise? On January 5, 1999, the Bonham County Commission voted to give a 22-cent per hour pay raise, but only to non-bargaining unit workers. Then and there, it's very clear that the vote for that year's wage increases occurred, and there was not going to be a wage increase for those members of the bargaining unit that were under this particular contract. Moreover, on March 31st, 1998, which was the preceding December, the union said to the county, "We reject your last offer, we're at impasse." On January 10th, 1999, the county informs the union that it agreed that they're in impasse. So by January 10th, everyone knew that they were in impasse. By January 5th, the vote had already occurred on the wage increase, not to give a wage increase to the bargaining unit at that time. There was nothing that occurred after that date that was necessary to give rise to this case. It would be our contention that if you were to apply federal labor law, as has traditionally been applied by this court, actually the union should have known back in May of 97. Because really the subsequent negotiations were nothing more than an attempt to break the impasse which existed when the county implemented its contract, including the management rights clause, back in May of 1997. So again, it would be our position that the statute of limitations is run and that claim was untimely. Second issue, again, it is our position that it is not an unfair labor practice to bargain impasse over the issue of management rights. Again, directly on point is the case of National Labor Relations Board versus American National Insurance. That case has been cited as authority in the Sisseton case by this court. Therein, the U.S. Supreme Court said it is not an unfair labor practice to bargain to impasse over the issue of management rights. Also, it's important to know that the Department of Labor in this case has adopted at least, if not more, three different positions with respect to management rights. In the Kingsbury County case, the administrative law judge said that essentially it is a per se unfair labor practice charge to bargain impasse over management rights. A different administrative law judge in the Bonham County case said that management rights clause was not per se unlawful, and that it was not unlawful to negotiate in favor of such a clause, but it's an unfair labor practice charge to bargain to impasse over it. Finally, in the Paynton County decision, which was referenced in here, we would ask that the court take judicial notice of it to the extent it can. Director James Marsh approved essentially language identical to what's at issue in here, herein, and approved the rationales offered by the county. Again, to the extent the Department of Labor has adopted disparate positions, we believe that they have, in fact, engaged in arbitrary and capricious rulings. Again,
hasn't this court, though, determined that there is no stare decisis with administrative decisions?
From a stare decisis standpoint, I would agree with that, Your Honor, but certainly it indicates how this particular agency is struggling with this issue. I see that I am out of time. I will be seated and reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Fowleson. Before Ms. Viking proceeds, the court should note for the record that we've had two disqualifications. Justice Sabres disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Jack Von Wall, the presiding judge of the Fifth Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Justice Zinner has also disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, retired Chief Justice of this court, to sit in his place. Ms. Viking, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Associate Justice, and sitting circuit judges, and welcome also from Justice Miller.
Counsel.
May it please the court. I want to make two important points that I think are extremely important for consideration in this case. The first is that there's a reason that we're here today in a South Dakota court and not in a federal courthouse. And that is because we're interpreting South Dakota's law and South Dakota's constitution. And there is a specific difference between public employment and private employment. And that was a key factor in the department's decisions in these cases. And we ask the court to also consider that as being significant in this case. Quite simply, public employees in South Dakota do not have the same rights as private employees, notably the right to strike. This creates an entirely different bargaining scenario. In addition, public employers have different rights and obligations. They have times that they have to have a budget in. They are elected and they have responsibilities. I think it's important to make the point here too, because counsel for management has raised it. There's been a lot of talk in some of these cases about, well, we have this great process that protects public employees. Even though they don't have the right to strike, they have this impasse procedure. Well, I'm here to say, after 30 years of being involved in this, both as a teacher on one end and as an attorney on the other end, that that process doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's not binding. We have conciliation. Okay, what happens at conciliation? The parties go in, someone from the Department of Labor tries to get them to agree. Now, what's the motivation for the county to agree? If they had a motivation, they would have agreed before that. They know when they go in there, they don't have to agree. They've been taught that, trust me. And they go in and they never reach agreement. Then we go to fact finding in some cases. In most cases, frankly, they don't go because it's meaningless. It's non-binding. So what happens? The fact finder makes his report or her report. What happens to that report? Nothing. The employer implements those parts that it was going to implement anyway, especially those it wins on, and doesn't implement the rest. And there's nothing that can be done about that. The only thing that can happen is what happened in this case, and that's an unfair labor practice. Complaint is filed, and a determination is made that there was a lack of good faith and or a violation of the other parts under the unfair labor practice statutes. I cannot emphasize to you enough the significance of this case to organized labor in the public sector in South Dakota. If the decisions of the department and the circuit court are not upheld, I fear that is the death toll for public sector unions.
So you're conceding that management has the right to bargain for this type of clauses?
You know,
the problem is with how they did it?
Your Honor, I think that question has two potential answers. One is that you could say no, they did not have the right to bargain at all, based on the Rapid City Education Association case, where this court has held that if it's preempted by statute, it is not mandatorily bargainable. One could argue that wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment are clear, and therefore you cannot bargain them at all, and that it was an unfair labor practice even to do that. Secondly, this court...
Is there a distinction between teachers and county employees because of the contracts that they enter into?
No, Your Honor, there is not.
There's no difference, sir. Okay.
No, the only difference is that the statute, 318.8.2, was put in originally for teachers, and I can tell you why that happened. That happened because there used to be a statute, which doesn't exist anymore, that said you had to issue contracts on May 1. Negotiations were often ongoing on May 1, and so some of us had to go to court a lot of times to get protection or to get temporary restraining orders to prohibit the board from putting those statutes into effect, or excuse me, putting their last best offer into effect before negotiations was completed. Therefore, we went to the legislature and put in the statute. Now, that statute does talk about school districts, although this court has applied it to other than school districts, but I think it clearly sets a tone, a pattern for what should happen in this case. While this court doesn't create law, this court does interpret law. This court can determine what good faith bargaining is. This court can determine whether management prerogative is a permissive subject or a mandatory subject. Perhaps this court should determine it's a permissive subject and can be laid on the table and talked about, but if the parties don't agree, it can't be imposed. That's the kind of thing that happens at the federal level. Would the unions have objection to that? No. And I also want to address this issue that was raised about the union not making an offer. They did make an offer. It's in the record. They made a specific offer, and it wasn't one or two lines. It was a specific proposal, probably stronger than I would have liked, frankly, on the management side. But it also clearly said you can't use this to discriminate against union members or to take away their rights guaranteed by law. That's the clarification they wanted. And they kept asking, tell us specifically what it is you want, what it is you need, and we'll talk about that. It wasn't their proposal. Why do they have to come up with the specifics?
I'm sorry, no, complete your thought.
I was just going to say, if you look at the record, it is very clear that time and again, the union said, tell us what it is specifically. Even this contracting out question that was raised, there's never been a problem with contracting out. Even when this agreement was not in place, imposed, that is, contracting out was done. There was testimony about that. There was never an issue. You never objected to that, as long as it was for the kinds of things that you would expect. Yes, Your Honor.
My question is it significant? True, first, is it true? And second, is it significant that in other counties the union has agreed to the identical management rights clause?
Glad you asked me that question. No, it's not significant. For one thing, the record is clear, and the department found that those are different unions with different goals, different individuals. But let me also tell you the real truth here. The real truth is that a lot of times that was put in as boilerplate and carried over year after year. And why did the union take a different stand now? The union took a different and stronger position now, quite frankly, based on decisions of this court and based on decisions of the Department of Labor. And based upon management starting to use those management rights prerogatives, management rights clauses, that they had never used before. And I believe in our brief I've cited several of those cases. For example, this court determined in Keckley that you could waive the rights, the statutory rights even, of your members, such as the standard grievance that's in the law. Then this court also held that you could, if it was in the last best offer, you could impose it. That's the Sisseton case. Now, the court looked specifically at that proposal and said it really wasn't broad discretion, and so it was okay. But those things start to worry those of us who represent labor unions about what will happen. And when the Department of Labor starts looking at management rights clauses and say they trump everything, as they did in the Sioux Falls assistance case, then we start saying, you better think about whether you're going to agree to these management rights clauses or not. And why did they stay in some cases? Peer coercion. If you read this record, these people in Kingsbury County, excuse me, in Bonham County, they went 3 years without a pay raise. They had a lot of strength, those guys, to stick together to bring this matter before the court. But that doesn't happen in every case, and that's why they're in there. And many of them are imposed, Your Honor, and some of, and many, as was pointed out, do not say what these say. And if you read the record in Mr. Dreesen's comments, he's pretty clear about this. He's going to put this in, he's going to impose it, then he's going to make it stronger and impose it, and pretty soon there'll be nothing to bargain. I think it was pretty clear in his testimony about that. And so where does that leave the unions? So that's why this is so important and significant to us. Let me address a couple of things that were raised by counsel as well.
Just to interrupt you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying that the negotiation of this type of clause is per se then bad faith?
That wasn't a holding of the department. They looked at the specific ones. I think that's a dilemma, Your Honor, to be very honest with you. It's why I suggested that perhaps it's permissive and not mandatory, because otherwise we're going to run into this problem time and time again about what it is that it can say and not say. This one is pretty clear in my estimation. I mean, you know, there's nothing left to negotiate if you accept what's here. But the difficulty is that, you know, what is or isn't then good faith negotiations. My personal belief is, yes, it's per se, and the reason it's per se is because there's statutory rights to bargain, they're being taken away. That is not the holding of the department or the circuit court, but it is my belief that without that kind of protection from this court, we will be litigating forever on this issue. There was a question raised about not being harmed. Well, first of all, this case has been on appeal. This case has been going on since 1998. And so there is some harm that's being done here. Negotiations are not ongoing. There have been no negotiations, because this issue has to get decided. This issue is holding up negotiations in a number of places. As you can tell by reading the amici briefs in this case, this doesn't affect just AFSCME. This affects all the teachers, all the public employees, the firefighters, the police officers, everyone is affected by this. And we're having this difficulty in every case now, because almost in every case, the management rights clause is being proposed. So there is harm. And if there isn't any harm, it's only because this court intervened and did not allow the decision to be withheld, the payments to be withheld. The Bonham County payments have been made, by the way. Except for those, as you indicated, who are no longer employees.
The pay raises have been implemented.
The ones ordered by the department, but not that ordered by the circuit court in the case where the court ordered the 10 cents extra. The LRC memo that was mentioned, it should also be noted in that memo, which is a huge memo, by the way. It's 26 pages or 28, but it's huge. Also in that memo, there are a couple other things that counsel didn't tell you about, and that is, if I may, excuse me. On page 10, it says, most states also have a management rights clause in their law, which generally provides that notwithstanding any agreement, the public employer is entitled to hire, direct, promote, etc. Legislature didn't do that. This was before them on that issue, if you want to talk about what was before the legislature. This memo also talks about the distinct difference between public and private employees. And this court has also found that distinction and said the state is not a public employer, and I believe it was West Central. I also want to answer that question of, and I'm surprised to hear it yet again, that the union tried to pick and choose what to implement. Please read the record. What the union said was, we assume you're going to implement your wage increase and the bereavement change. Then when Mr. Dreesen got all upset about that and wrote back and said, you don't get to pick, Paul Allward wrote and said, well, we weren't saying that. We just wanted to be sure you were implementing everything, and those are the important things for us. That's all that was said. On the timeliness issue, the record is pretty clear about that, but let me just make this point about that. January 25th was the implementation date. That's the date we believe triggered it. Should have known they were going to commit an unfair labor practice on January 25th. I mean, the problem with this idea that you have to, when you get a guess this is going to happen, file an unfair labor practice is You're going to be filing them, as Justice Meyer Henry would know, about every 60 days in order to make this work. They waited until they did take the official action to implement it. That's when they raised the issue, and that's when their filing was made. And on the timeliness issue, by the way, that issue of March 21st versus March 29th, I think, is pretty clear in the record since it's in the record. But I would also note that in the post-trial brief of counsel for management, they acknowledged it was March 25th. And I don't know if you have that in the record or not, but... But their brief reads, it cannot be disputed that the union did not file its complaint until March 25th, 1999. I don't think they should be contesting it now in light of their own admission that it was the correct date. Counsel also indicated that he was going to address the mediation issue, and so I want to address that just a second, if I may, although he didn't have time to do that. One of the issues raised is whether in conciliation that offer that was made, that 10 cents, should be considered, and the circuit court determined it should be. And the reason I believe that to be accurate is that that is not a genuine kind of mediation, quote unquote, in the statute, and I've cited the differences that I believe are there. I would also argue that it is moot because that same offer of 30 cents versus 20 cents was made after conciliation and before the last unfair labor practice complaint. So even if there was error there, it's not dispositive because that offer was actually made. And what the circuit court determined is that those offers were genuinely made, we hope, at least in good faith, and they wouldn't have been made if the county hadn't budgeted for them, and the testimony shows they had budgeted for these increases. They just refused to give them. Why did they refuse? Because the union would not agree to the management rights clause. That's the only reason. There's been no other reason ever given. And the reason and the need, as Justice Konenkamp asked about the need for this clause, nothing was really demonstrated. Time and again, the union said, tell us specifically. Tell us what it is. And why is this of extreme concern? It's of extreme concern because the Department of Labor has held that if something is in your last contract, and then it's reimposed, there is an agreement reached in the next negotiation, it's reimposed, that's not an unfair labor practice because you agreed to it once. That's why these issues become so important.
Let me ask the other side of that question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know your position that you're not obligated to try to parse their proposal, but can you tell me what specific rights do you believe that this management rights clause took away from the laborers in these counties?
If you look at the specific clause, Your Honor, it deals with things like transferring, things like hours, as Justice Meyer Henry asked about, excuse me. It talks about issues that, in fact, there's a very good letter, Your Honor, in Kingsbury County, in the Kingsbury County case, and in fact it is included in Judge Covey's decision. She specifically sets out in her decision the letter where Mr. Allwood specifically talked about the provisions. There were other things besides those, but those particular provisions were, he went through them. And some of those were changed because they didn't agree with anything. I mean, they were private sector things. It didn't make any sense. But if you just read it in its broadest terms, and again, we have to read it in its broadest terms because the department has started saying that if it says it, the management rights clause, you're allowed to do this, then that's going to trump it if it's nowhere else or if it's not explicitly clear somewhere else.
So you're saying this letter does set forth...
That letter sets forth many of them.
Right.
Not all of them, Your Honor. I think the testimony also set forth the other parts of it. And in fact, if you read, if you read the questioning that I had with Mr. Dreesen, he specifically acknowledged, as was recognized by the administrative law judges, that these were mandatorily negotiable subjects. He acknowledged it, if there was even a question about it. So it's extremely important for us that we look at this issue from the standpoint of the potential harm that it can do.
Now, would you explain then one more time so that I understand? The public employees cannot strike.
Correct.
How do you think this fits into your argument, and where would we apply that in our analysis?
I think we apply it the same way the two administrative law judges did, and that is that recognizing that they do not have the right to strike, they do not have the parity that exists in private sector. Therefore, we have to look at what the legislature then gave them in return. And what they gave them was certain rights, rights to form labor unions, to have them be their exclusive representative on wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment. And because there is no way for them, except through you, to ensure that they have those rights, the court has to recognize they can't go out and strike. They don't. What pressure do they have? Really, what pressure do they have on state employee, on the state, or on the county, or on the school district? They really don't have any. That's why you must protect what was given to them, which is good faith negotiations on these issues. You have made it clear. You have a number of cases on management prerogatives, and you've made it clear that when it's an inherent decision of government, they don't get to negotiate on that. And that's appropriate, although they might be able to negotiate on the effect of it. Procedure versus substance, you've talked about. But in this instance, they need to be able to know that they can have what's given to them. There's also this issue...
Your time has expired.
I do have a question, though. I want to follow up on what Justice Meyerhinder just asked about, maybe ask you. It seems to me, though, that you're asking us to... The legislature, everything you've just mentioned are things that you're entitled to under the law.
Right.
But it seems to me, in reading your brief, you're asking for us to create some kind of counterbalancing policy beyond just those rights. You give me an example. It seems to me you're asking for more than simply that. Am I wrong on that?
I think that the only issue that would be true of, Your Honor, is implementation of the last best offer. And I don't think that's beyond what the legislature intended or what this court has authority to do. And the reason I say that is, unless you require implementation of last best offer, similar to what the legislature has stated in the education cases, and why was it just education? Because that was the only issue, quite honestly, Your Honor. The other cases, they'd always implemented their last best offer. That's one of the differences between public and private that has caused a problem here. There's not continuous negotiations in public sector. It ends when the cycle ends.
Right. So you want us to expand the breadth of that statute as a counterbalance for the denial of the right to strike?
I would say it this way. I want you to recognize the legislative directive that it is important to implement what you have offered, because if you offered it in good faith, then you should be willing to implement it. Otherwise, there is no meaning to negotiations if in the end you can decide, well, you didn't agree to everything we want, so I'm just going to implement what I want. I'm not going to give you wages. The coercive nature of that takes away the good faith negotiations, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Viken. Mr. Fallison, you have 10 minutes, sir.
If I may, allow me to briefly address the two arguments I did not get to on my direct. And
No, you can't do that because she doesn't get a chance to get up and respond.
Very well.
You can rely on your brief.
With respect to the arguments made by counsel for the union, I'd just like to highlight, Ms. Viken mentioned that one of the reasons why we need to sort of adopt a new sort of scheme here in South Dakota is because public employees do not have the right to strike. That is true. However, much as the Pasco case from the state of Washington, an en banc decision in the Supreme Court of Washington, which is cited in our materials, there are other things that public employees have that private employees do not. And this is something that's been recognized by our state legislature, again, since 1969. In the legislative report that we referenced, they mention the following. Public employees still have political clout, and management's privilege to disregard an agreement may be more theoretical than real in light of the employee's political power and adverse public opinion. The legislature, as part of its fact-finding and resolution procedure, has adopted a provision whereby either party can request fact-finding and to have those findings published in the local newspaper. Again, public employees have the ability to impose significant political pressures on elected officials in order to get them to change whatever position they've adopted in negotiations. Furthermore, these negotiations cannot be viewed in a vacuum. To the extent an employer is arguably paying below market wages or having provisions which do not treat employees fairly, those employees can clearly pick up, go to the next county, go to the nearby city, go work for someone else, which would place the county in a rather precarious position to be able to provide the public services that they're statutorily required to provide.
I want to go back to something that council said, though, to get your response to it. She said that your negotiator, Mr. Dreesen, acknowledged that some of the things that would have been covered by this waiver clause were mandatory negotiable subjects of...
Yep, absolutely. Anything...
You were asking the unions, just to get this clear, you were asking the unions to give up some of their rights with respect to conditions of employment.
That happens anytime you implement provisions. Let's change the subject from management rights to wages. Let's say our last offer is 10 cents, the union wants 50 cents an hour. We implement the 10 cents. We have now taken away, in essence, the union's ability to negotiate over that 10 cents. We have bargained in good faith, we've reached impasse, and at that point can implement. It matters not whether the provision is wages, the hours that they work during the week, or a management rights provision. Management rights provisions are nothing new. The union would seem to paint this picture that they've arisen out of nowhere, that they're just this dark cloud hanging over public sector negotiations in South Dakota. They have been here since 1969. They're a very common practice. And again, the evidence in the record demonstrates that they have had, no adverse impact on the employees of the unions. There are other outside issues that come to play on why the county treats its employees fairly. The economy being one, political pressure by the employees is another. With respect to a question that was raised to Unions Council about whether our statutes distinguish between teacher negotiations and negotiations for other non-teacher public employers, again, the statute that is directly at issue in this case, which deals with implementation, clearly in its own terms, in its own definition, and I quote from the title of that particular statute, it says, issuance of contracts by school districts, that's 3-18-8.2, begins any school district issuing contracts to teachers. That's how the statute begins. Clearly, that statute is narrow and unique to school district teacher negotiations. That has been recognized by this court in Board of Regents versus Hagee, in which it said that provision is limited in scope to school districts. So it is our position that there is some distinction to be drawn between school district negotiations and other public negotiations here in the state of South Dakota. Again, one of the arguments made by the union is the desire of the county to contract out if they wanted to do things, and the union's argument was we've never stopped them from doing it in the past. Again, to the extent that is a mandatory subject of bargaining and it's not in the management rights clause, arguably we have to go to the bargaining table with them every time we wish to do it. Past practice of not negotiating that is not going to affect future decisions. A union could at any time, absent a management rights clause, say, whoa, you cannot negotiate with your contract out with Union County. We want to negotiate over that, over the decision and the effects of that. And so, again, the fact that they haven't objected in the past does not govern their future behavior. To adopt the position as advocated by the union in this case, I believe would put the courts of the state and the Department of Labor in a rather difficult position. Essentially, I believe the union, their position is to be adopted, they'd be asking the courts to micromanage what is contained within a management rights provision. As is highlighted in this case, and we believe that there is a distinction between the three administrative law judge opinions that have been cited, Bonham, Kingsbury, and Pennington. Again, if it has one phrase, is it okay? If it has another phrase, is it not okay? At what point does a management rights clause become permissible, and does it become not an unfair labor practice to bargain to impasse over that issue?
But it seems to me that if we don't do that, if we don't look at this on a case-by-case basis, then we buy into an ideology here, either one side or the other. And the way I look at the other cases around the country, even the cases cited by both sides, the courts do look at the specific clause and say, you know, this particular clause is overbearing or this particular clause is acceptable. What you seem to be saying is that we should simply say that any clause is acceptable. It's all negotiable.
I believe it would be our position that that is a matter to be decided at the bargaining table. As counsel for the union mentioned, some states have adopted a management rights provision in state statutes.
But if we say, okay, it's to be decided at the bargaining table, then doesn't the county just win then? Because the county can just say, well, the unions won't agree to it, so we're going to implement it, and therefore we've got what we wanted.
We would disagree because, again, that assumes that, I believe, looks at the situation in a vacuum. If that were the case, then counties, barring a minimum wage, would pay $1 an hour and work their employees 100 hours a week. The fact of the matter is there are outside influences, economic influences, political influences, which put tremendous pressure on a political body to reach an agreement with their particular employee organization.
No, we're not in that forum. The forum here is the forum of the courts, and our obligation is to look at the good faith of this, not to say, well, we're going to let the winds of chance or political winds change things. We have to look at this in terms of the good faith, don't we?
Correct. Good faith bargaining is certainly the standard by which negotiations are to be examined. Again, it's our contention that the record demonstrates that what you had here was hard bargaining, which is lawful under federal law, recognized by this court. And again, to the extent a party adopts a position, states a rationale, again, at what point does it become micromanaging of whether this particular provision has the right language on it or whether it does not? As mentioned by unions counsel, some states have decided to go ahead and adopt a state statute that says here are the management rights. Our legislature didn't do that. So it is left to the union and the county to fight that issue out at the bargaining table. One of the reasons why the county said, and this is in the record, why they want a management rights provision is it's not stated in state statute. If we don't negotiate it and get in the contract, arguably we don't have that right. And so that conscious decision by the legislature not to have a management rights statute is the reason why we have to go to the bargaining table and fight for those particular issues. Let me just conclude. If stepping back and listening to the argument made by the union, it's our position that that argument is best made one floor above the state legislature. The argument made by the union was that the process we have doesn't work because it's not binding. Again, that was a conscious decision by the elected representatives of the state legislature to adopt the process which they have adopted. Management rights clauses are nothing new. They've been around since 1969. They are not, again, the specter, hanging dark cloud hanging over negotiations. And we would ask that this court reverse the decision of the circuit court and the Department of Labor to the extent they find that the county bargained unfairly for the management rights provisions. We would ask that this court reverse the decision of the circuit court with respect to the mediation, allowing evidence from a mediation, which is directly contrary to two state statutes we've cited. We would ask that this court reverse the decision of the circuit court with respect to the remedies that were granted in this particular case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess for approximately 10 minutes.